Now thank we all our God with hearts and hands and voices, who wondrous things hath done, in whom this world rejoices, who from our mother's arms hath blessed us on our way with countless gifts of love, and still is ours today.
My name is Don Rudrud, and we are beginning today a new series, a series that will include four sessions this week. This topic today is Beyond Quotas Towards a Truly Inclusive Church, and the specific theme of the whole series is about inclusivity, or how we in Christian ministry are concerned about including a big world that we are part of, and especially in this country, a pluralistic nation of many kinds of people and many life experiences. I'm a parish pastor in an inner city church in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm here as a carpenter and a student. I'm on a sabbatical leave for 3 months, and they've also asked me to teach a little bit, and I'm delighted to do that. I'm teaching today about a subject that's very close to my heart, and I'm trying to reflect a little bit as I think a lot up here about why this subject is so close to my heart. I think it's because I was born in California, and I lived a good bit of my life in California. I lived in California where there were a growing number of people that were different than I. And I learned to go to school with these people and to see them out of the windows of my car as I drove down to downtown Los Angeles to go to school. And as I went to the beach, I became aware of the folk. And yet I didn't see them in my church. And I didn't see them in my parents' social groups. All we had a black servant who at times came to the house to work. But that wasn't a truly equal partnership with people of color. But I've always had something of California in me, and a special concern for the tremendous developments that are happening in California now. I've studied in California a few times over the last years of my life while I've been in Minnesota in ministry. One thing I'm told, that by the year 2000, over half of all the people living in California will be foreign-born. Say that again. By the year 2000, over half of all the people living in the state of California will be foreign-born. They're either born in Korea, Southeast Asia, Mexico, Central America. They're coming from all over the world. And this makes it a whole new ballgame. Well, California is one of the things that's affected the way I think about pluralism. But the other factor is that my first parish was in a public housing project in North Minneapolis, where our neighborhood was made up of blacks, Indians, and poor whites. I learned a lot about the black community during the 60s and had the privilege of working side by side with many black people who gave me great gifts. I learned something about why they were filled with rage. I learned something of their history and what they have to contribute to us. And more recently, my parish now is in a neighborhood that has some 15,000 American Indians in it, and another large group of Southeast Asian refugees. And so I find myself in communities trying to minister in the name of a Lutheran church that are predominantly mixed race and of many different cultures. And so I'm very interested in the question about inclusivity. And yet when I use the word inclusive around my own congregation, the people don't always understand it. And some people jump to conclusion of me that we're talking about whether we talk about God as mother or father. Well, that's part of it, but I'm using a definition that's a bit broader, and I'm basing some of my thoughts today on a very good document prepared by a multiracial task force of the American Lutheran Church called Visions of an Inclusive Church. I'm sorry it's not available here, but you'd be welcome to borrow this and look at my copy if you'd like, and if you'd like a copy of your own, it can be easily secured from the Division of Church and Society of the American Lutheran Church. They use a definition of inclusive as follows. Inclusive is a way of being that promotes wholeness in the midst of diversity and honors the distinctive gifts of all people. Are you with me so far with that definition? Wholeness in the midst of diversity. Inclusiveness is not just a melting pot idea that everybody kind of gets boiled into one. But inclusiveness honors the fact that people are different. We use a word a lot in our neighborhood in Minneapolis now, and the word is kaleidoscope. You know those kaleidoscopes that you look at and you see all the different colors and they come to different arrangements, but they never get all kind of melted together to one color, but they're always distinct, and it's beautiful as you see the different aspects and the different colors become prominent. Kaleidoscope, it's a good word. Another good word is tapestry. The great tapestries in the art of the world will bring many different colors, and seen all together in this huge panorama, it's the wonder of life. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about inclusive, especially as it involves the church. Here are some characteristics of an inclusive church. Let's start with the scriptures image. You see it in many places. There's one body and many members. All are not meant to be the hand or the foot or the eye. There's neither Greek nor Jew, male or female. We are one in Christ, but some of us are different than others, and all of us are different than others, really. Another definition of the church can be found in the words of Dr. Vassar de Hoof, the former director of the World Council of Churches, which stated it this way: the church is supra-racial in a sense that color is of no significance at all. The church is the people of God, and as such, it is called together to serve all humanity and cannot become the monopoly of any one race or nation. Now, I know the context from which he speaks, for he knows very well the fact that people of color make up the majority of the church in the world. That the place where the church is growing fastest now is Africa, Indonesia, Korea. That by the year 2000, possibly in my lifetime, the center of the Christian world will no longer be in Europe or America, but it'll be south of the equator. I mean, we do live truly in a multicultural church, but what does that say about an inclusive church in this land in which I live? Here are some of my basic starting points. Number one, the church that is inclusive will celebrate diversity. Will celebrate the fact that people are not all the same. It will celebrate their cultural variety. Number two, the church will transcend cultural limitations because of the love of Christ. The love of Christ will so motivate us that we will move beyond our own little cultural ghettos. Number three, the truly inclusive church will share power equally. And we must admit that power in American Protestantism has very much been in the hands of white people. But that will change in an inclusive church. There will be a sharing of power. And number four, we will promote the equal representation and participation of people in color. One of the things that concerns me about a quota system is if it just puts a black face or an Indian face sitting at a table with a bunch of very powerful white PhDs, there is no real sharing of power. So we will have to work to the point where there is more than a sharing of representation, but there will be a sharing of participation and decision making. And finally, we must raise up in our midst for us all to see some examples of inclusiveness of a church that is multicultural, for many of us have not had the opportunity to be a part of such a community. Let me ask you a few questions, and I do this not to embarrass anybody. I just think that we need to get the facts out in the table. How many of you are now members of a congregation that includes people of other race than yourself? How many of you would say that at least 25% of your congregation is people of another race? Okay. How many of you people are part of a congregation served by a female pastor? How many of you have the pastor that, with more than one pastor, your senior pastor being a female? Okay. How many of you find yourself, anyone here, find yourself living in a community where you are the minority group, being white?
Okay. Churches in Minnesota.
Yeah, okay. Well, these are a few questions just to kind of understand a little bit where you're coming from. I would like some of you that have had experience in these kind of situations to share too, and I'll try to allow time for that. For I sometimes have more questions than answers about way we really get to this church that is multicultural. I'm living in the neighborhood with all of these people of so many cultures. But, for example, to bring in the American Indian people from our neighborhood into active membership in a Lutheran church has been very, very difficult. And I find that many times my role as a Christian is to affirm their own form of Christian worship and groupings, even though it means that I do not worship with them on Sunday morning. Our history as American Protestants has been pretty dismal as far as involving people that are different. I think we must maybe realize that for a lot of us, we have been moving more and more towards cultural homogeneity rather than diversity. I think of my own tradition. I come from a Norwegian Lutheran tradition. When those folks came over on the immigration boats and sought a church life in America, they sought some kind of security in people that were from the old country, that thought like they did, that worshiped in the same language and taught the catechism in the same language, and they found some kind of home there. The first question was asked is, who speaks Norwegian around here? The second question was asked is, where are the Lutherans around here? And as the Lutheran Norwegians got together, they formed strong churches. But as we read the text about from Acts about the gospel being sent from Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth, I'm afraid my Scandinavian relatives interpreted it as something like this. From Jerusalem, being Norway, to Judea, meaning the upper Midwest, to Samaria, if possibly you move out to California or to Arizona because you there can find the Lutheran Norwegians that kind of gather in your own community. When I was a boy, I couldn't tell the difference between my local Lutheran church and the Sons of Norway organization. It was the same organization. They just met over at Sons of Norway to drink and dance, and they met over at the church to pray, but it was the same group. Now we've gone Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. What we've usually interpreted that to mean is we'll send a few of us to be foreign missionaries over at some other land, and there they'll relate to the black people. Huh? That is the kind of tradition that I've come out of. And maybe it's not been unlike you if you've come out of a German tradition or a Swedish tradition. Someone has said that Lutherans are like a tribe. We're like a tribe. We're very much, we have our own little in stories and in relationships and in, you know, we're sort of like a net all fastened to each other. We're intermarried with each other. We know each other. We went to the same Lutheran colleges. You can lift up part of us and we kind of are connected. Yeah, I find this at Holden. I come to Holden Village and I find people I'm connected with all over the country by friendships or relatives or people who went to my college or whatever. We're like a tribe. But tribes don't usually reach out to people of other tribes, and tribes aren't real good at incorporating or including people that are of different backgrounds and cultures, and certainly Lutherans have not done a good job in incorporating people of other races. There have been a few cases of outreach to poor and black communities, but after all is said and done over a lot of years, we must face the fact that within this decade that we are living, only 0.6% of Lutherans in America are people of color. Less than 1% of all Lutherans in America are people of color. Barb Rossing, our pastor here, said in a sermon at Holden Village this summer something that we all didn't want to believe until I found a proof for it, and that is that the American Lutheran Church is the most racially segregated major denomination in America. That's the church body I'm a part of, folks. And maybe you are too. Now we can say there are some reasons for that. Let's face it that a lot of people of color do not choose to live in the upper Midwest. And a lot of Norwegians and Germans do. But that's only part of the explanation. For we have long been operating in the Philadelphia area or in New York City, or it's not just brand new that we've been in California. But what makes things almost a little more dismal is to see that while the non-white population of America has been growing, and the largest and fastest growing groups are groups like Hispanics, Spanish-speaking people, who are coming as immigrants and are coming and having more and more children, in states like my home state of California, the Lutheran population is going down. We not only are not adding these people of color into our churches, but we are even losing the strength that we have had in those states. And that's a distressing thing. I want to give you a few statistics. Some of them may confuse you, but just let them kind of drift right by. But they might help too. Right now, as we go into a new Lutheran church, over 50% of our members in the new Lutheran church, LCA, ALC, and ALC, over 50% live in the north central region of the United States. That's the states of Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, North and South Dakota. That's where over 50% of the members of our new Lutheran church reside and currently live. And yet, over half of America's population now lives in the South and the West. The areas that are growing in the United States are Texas and Arizona and Florida and California. That's where the people are moving, but the strength of the Lutheran Church is still sitting in the upper Midwest. I've already told you that by the year 1990, or I didn't say this, let me quote this, by the year 1990, the majority of Californians will consist of what we call minorities. I like the definition of minority that says a minority isn't just a small group. A minority is any group that is not sharing in power. A minority is any group that is lorded over by another group that has the power. Over 50% of the state of California will be of this so-called minority. By the year 1990 and by the year 2000, over half foreign-born. Just to show a little bit about population gain, from 1970 to 1980, my home state of California increased by 13.5%, and the highest percentage of those were people of color, but membership in the ALC and the LCA churches declined in California during that time. Well, I'd like to pause a little bit and say, is this stuff I've been talking about makes sense from your experience? Do you see this kind of stuff that I've been saying in the church that you're a part of or in the community you're a part of? Or would you like to show me some disagreement? Because I'd like to find some other things going on. Yeah.
Do they just drop from the church anyplace then? Or what religion is growing?
Yeah. That's a very good question. And I think others can help. One thing that I've been learning is that there's a great school of church outreach, growth, and mission in Southern California, Pasadena, called Fuller. And a man named McGovern and several others there have studied church growth and what's going on. One thing they've come to the conclusion is that the church tends to grow where people are part of a church that is of the same cultural group that they are. And the church tends to grow if it represents the kind of understanding of Christianity and religion that they remember back home when they were younger. Now, what's happened is that some people have moved to other parts of the country and have not necessarily stayed with the Lutheran Church. They have found a church that they think is the way it was when they were young back in the Midwest. Tremendous popularity of someone like Dr. Schuller in California, for example. Schuller attracts a lot of folks that come out of a Lutheran tradition because he seems to represent something about the successful, growing, large church that they remember in the Midwest. Whereas if they go down the street in Garden Grove, California, they'll see a struggling little ALC Lutheran church that can hardly survive. So that's part of what's going on. There are churches that are growing in the South and in California. And I'll have to say, praise God, some of them are intercultural, interracial churches. They tend to be fundamentalist, Pentecostal, Baptist. They tend to have a theology that somehow makes them very mission-oriented and very evangelical. And instead of being like a tribe, like Lutheranism tends to be, they are a mission station. And so they're very outgoing, and they're constantly involved in inviting people to their church. How long since you've really been pushed to do that in a Lutheran church? In fact, I suspect, and I'm saying this from within, I'm not criticizing anybody that I'm not a part of, but I suspect that several churches of the Lutheran tradition don't really want to grow. They don't want to gain new members, certainly not members of other race or culture, for they're kind of comfortable. And it's sort of nice to be with people like us and to sing the same kind of songs and to hear the same kind of sermons and to tell the same kind of Norwegian jokes and everything that goes with it. So we got one problem, and the question is, do we even want to grow with these people? Yeah.
I'm just wondering if anybody else has had the thought that in view of what you're saying, and in view of the fact that Holden is part of, quote, the church, why aren't we seeing any blacks or minorities in this situation? Maybe it's just this week.
No, it's all summer.
Is it an economic situation, or is it because there's such a small portion there in the Lutheran church? But I see no evidence of any in this situation.
Well, let's start with one thing. If we just talk about where we might draw blacks or minorities, if you're only drawing from 0.6 of a population of a church, you're not going to draw too many right there. And many times those that are part of us are individual families or small groups. A lot of people who come to Holden come in a larger group.
I don't think there's any effort made, too. Well, in
defense of Elmer Witt and this program, I'd have to say that there has been effort. In fact, I was led to believe that Holden was offered to the Black Coalition or Black Caucus of Lutherans to come and have a conference here. And for several reasons, that didn't work out. This coming summer, I've already heard plans to involve several Black theologians teaching, an attempt to bring the teaching staff into some Black leadership. That's Will Hertzfeld is a famous Black leader in the AELC. He's been here a lot. His son worked this summer on the staff. But I'd still say, this place is not racially inclusive, and it hasn't been as long as I've been connected with it up here this summer. But there are some good reasons for that, and maybe we could spend the rest of the hour talking why. Yeah.
Okay, that why. I think there was a reason for the exclusiveness that you've indicated earlier was the language.
Yeah.
My father worked through that and took three congregations in his ministry, entirely from German to entirely to English.
Yeah.
I don't think we really examined now in the church, what are the exclusive factors? And I think it's more than nationality. I think nationality, which was once a blessing, has now become a bane. And I think a part of the problem is you said from the Fuller Seminary and American church growth, is the matter of homogeneity. We're not willing to deal with that in the sense in which that study has dealt with it. And then I think the other is our orders of service. We still insist upon worshiping as a North European worshiping congregation and have not become American in our worship style. I see that in community I've served for many years in the Beaverton, Portland area. That's been our problem.
Yeah. Although when you say our, I'm sometimes wondering whether that's the laity's problem or the clergy's problem. The whole question of being free to allow people to worship in different ways, and a pastor being free to say, hey, it's okay if we have black style of worship in this church, at least as an option. This is one of the most troubling things I've been discovering, and this is getting in me into two sessions from now, but I'm willing to jump in there so I don't lose it then, and that is one of the troubles that we did in American history. By the way, we systematically excluded black people from mainline Protestantism, and we did. I mean, there are stories in early Philadelphia where committed black Christians who were freed slaves came into churches and were told, you can't worship here, or you must go up in the balcony where everything's painted black, or something like that. And these people got so fed up with this finally that they just formed their own denominations, the AME Church, the AME Zion, and so on. But what happened is that the black church became more and more excluded or sort of set into separate organizations, and they lost the sense of the body of Christ, the oneness of the church, and their whole sense of an ecumenical church didn't really flower and develop as it did in mainline Protestantism. They found their identity in blackness, They found their identity in the search for freedom. They found their identity in all of their cultural things that became centered. Their Sons of Norway organization was their church. Okay? And, you know, that was all good for the black community, but we've been impoverished by that. We've been greatly impoverished because all the richness of the black history, the black preaching, the black gifts to America have tended to be in that little church somewhere else in the community. And what made it worse is because of economic conditions. And that, by the way, is a major reason why the people of color are not here. It just costs too much. Not just while you're here, but to get here. But because of economic conditions, many times black leadership has had to be working people, working in secular jobs, and just preaching on Sunday, which meant they couldn't develop full orb the Christian education programs, the kind of community service and community advocacy that should have been done among the poor community. So that's another dilemma. Anybody else? Yeah.
Even though you get some of these people into the church, and our church welcomes people of all races, you get those people as well as some of the Caucasian people. Are they going to feel comfortable in the set liturgy, the formal language that is used and all? It becomes so formal that they lose the real meaning there. Huh. Is there something wrong with our formality?
Well, I think that's already been suggested, and we've got to change. I mean, the issue isn't black people changing or Asians changing, it's the issue is us. We have a white problem, and it has to do with racism. You know, we have structured ourselves not only in the way we do worship, but the way we do college and seminary education, the kind of courses we require people to take, and everything. You know, I have a young man now working with me who's Puerto Rican, and I had an Indian woman working with me last year as a student. And that Puerto Rican guy comes to me and he says, I'm supposed to lead chapel over at the seminary and I got to pick a hymn for Lent. And I look through the whole Lenten section in this green book and the only one I know is, Were You There When They Crucified My Lord? I mean, I had to tell him about the old favorites, you know. And what I do with that man is I ask him to bring his accordion into our worship service and he plays his accordion and he plays his bongo drums in church. I mean, we just got to allow that kind of freedom. Now, I do that at a little bit of a risk because it happens in my congregation, there's no other Latin rhythm folks there. There's no Spanish-speaking people sitting out there on Sunday morning, but we're just kind of doing a little sign of some future dream even by allowing it to happen. Many churches will have to learn to have two or three worship opportunities during the week in different cultural styles. And in sometimes in foreign languages. I mean, just looking back in my history, it was because the church was in the Norwegian language that kept the Lutheran church alive a while in this country before they converted over to English. So it must be with Southeast Asian languages. So it probably will be with Hispanics. There will be a need to worship in their own language. And then formulate the faith and the culture and the worship in their own thought forms. Absolutely important. But what about the question of inclusiveness? Can we be all included together somehow, too, without melting all together? Can we invite people of different cultures into our fellowship without asking them to deny who they are? And that is a tricky question. And that's something I want to talk about, especially in the next two times that we're going to deal with. The subject tomorrow is, can the Lutheran Church get out of whiteface? And we'll talk about that a little more specifically. And then the last session, I'd like to look at some alternate models of theological education and training that are very exciting to me about how we can not just require a black person from Alabama to go to Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota to take 4 years to learn how to minister to black people or us. But I don't want to get into that quite yet, because then I won't have anything to say the last day.
Yeah. I want to question the phrase you're using, racism.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that it is racism that brings about the exclusiveness. But I think it is the other things we've talked about. I worked for 10 years in Eskimo missions in Alaska.
Yeah.
And there's a whole host of things that kept those Eskimos from worshiping in their own style. And we insisted upon the red hymnal. And then when the green hymnal came out, we insisted upon the green hymnal. And what they really appreciate is the guitar and the cowboy music. Yeah. But we had a missionary from New Guinea who came and for 5 years served and did a fine piece of work because he didn't get caught up with the American style.
That's great. But I don't know, but you don't call that racism. You don't call that racism by insisting on a certain form of worship that happens to be ours?
No, I think that's something else.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we may want to talk about that a little bit. I'd like to quote the definition of racism used in this document, developed by people of color, by the way. This isn't a white person's word. But here's what they call racism. They say, racism is still very much with us in the American Lutheran Church. Racism includes not only prejudice against persons of other skin colors or languages, but also prejudice against the ways of other groups. Ways of processing information, of celebrating, of building community, of bringing about change. Racism is the assumption that one or more races are superior to another race or races. Now, I am a racist by that definition. I went to St. Olaf College, where I was taught tremendous cultural pride in my Scandinavian American heritage. I learned to read Ibsen and learned to appreciate the music of Grieg. I learned to have great pride in the philosophy department of my college. And I found that I had to deal with the fact when I started to work with black people that I not only didn't know who their great thinkers were, but I didn't know about their music or their art or their culture. I was impoverished by the fact that I'd been so indoctrinated with my own race and my own history that I could not affirm in others. Saw somebody over here, Barry.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think very often that we want to define racism in terms of emotions or things that are conscious, and so that we don't consider anything that's structural to be racist, because we don't feel like we have that emotional prejudice that we consciously feel. We don't feel that kind of superiority and that kind of hatred, so therefore we don't term it as racism. And yet, for me, some of the most dangerous forms of racism that we face are those de facto structural forms of racism that are very subtle and that nobody takes responsibility for. The things like the style of worship and the things like the suburban-urban dynamics and the way that that's very racist in the terms of the people who have the resources sort of sucking the resources from other people. And those are things that nobody consciously thinks I'm being racist because I live in a particular place or I do certain things, but that's still there. It's still institutional. And it has to be seen as racism, so people start taking responsibility for it.
I've now begun to understand more and more why that's true, and it has a lot to do with what you just said in terms of a kind of structural racism which is built into our whole system. Well, I'll talk more about that later. Way in the back.
I was brought up in Methodist.
Yes.
I'm not Scandinavian, but I didn't marry anointed. But I was refused. So to be there with my God and the Lutheran God.
Mm-hmm. But see, that kind of hurdle we've crossed now, and we're talking in the Lutheran tradition of very soon sharing pulpit altar fellowship not only with Methodists but with Episcopalians and maybe with Catholics. But what about the issue that goes beyond that? What about sharing communion with someone who also smokes the tobacco as part of an Indian sweat lodge ceremony? What about the use of the burning of sage within a congregation's worship? How pluralistic dare we get in terms of allowing people that are vastly different than we are to be part of our life?
I trusted God and accepted me in my religion.
Yeah.
In communion. So that Lutheran God wouldn't accept me.
Yeah. Yeah. Which brings you back to the interesting question of whose supper is it anyway? Really want to do that, we don't know how. I've implied already that the seminary I went to, when I when I had no Hispanic students to study with, I had no Black Americans to study with, I had no American Indians to study with, I'm obviously going to learn a certain cultural way to do things, and as a leader, I'm going to bring that out of my ministry. So one of my big concerns is how we change the whole way we develop leadership in the church. And you get me too much on what I want to talk about the next couple of days, because the topic today is the quota system, and the question is whether we should go with that one or not. And so I want to get you into that before we just lose it all here. And that is, what do we mean by quota system? The day after the decision was finally made, just a couple months, and it happened while I was up here, the day after the decision was finally made to accept the quota system in the New Lutheran Church, the Lutheran Church made the front page of the New York Times, I think for the first time we've ever made the front page of the New York Times. And it was the fact that we were going to, in fact, institute a quota system in our New Lutheran Church, and this was unique among all American denominations. I'm convinced that the reason we are doing that and have to do that is because we are in such a miserable shape in terms of really reaching that great biblical ideal of people of all races and cultures sitting together at the Lord's table. We have to work at the fact of our exclusiveness. Here's what the quota system is saying, and this is not written in the documents. If they've been changed while I've been up here in Holden, please let me know, but I think I've still got the official statement. Number one. At least 60% of all voting people at every committee, assembly, Senate convention, and national convention must be, by constitution, lay people. They must be lay persons, unordained. There was a time in the history of Lutheranism when clergy not only dominated the decisions, but they were clearly the majority even in the delegates. In my old Norwegian church tradition, every pastor went to the National Church Convention. It was like homecoming for them. This new church will be inclusive of lay persons in a new way that you have ever seen. You will not be able to go to any meeting that is not dominated at least by 60% lay people. That brings us to number two. One half of these must be women. Not of these, one half of the total of everybody. One half of the voters at the conventions or whatever. Women and one half men. Now maybe your district or region of the church is already at that point. In my area, we are at that point. We've been at that point for quite a while. It hasn't been hard to get that. As a matter of fact, some are bemoaning the fact that not only have the women always run our congregations, but they seem to more and more be taking on more of the leadership. My church council is run by a very able woman lawyer right now, and at least 60% of my church council is women. We've got to be affirmative action and try to find some men to get their leadership, but at least half will be women. And related to that certainly is the understanding that women clergy will be having more and more of a public role in leadership, and you will see them as they've been on the committee to form the Lutheran Church, you'll see them up in the top officers of the church also. The third portion is the portion that we've had the most trouble with and we've argued the most about and we've now come to some peace with, and that is a minimum goal. The minimum goal is that at least, we can't be satisfied with less, at least 10% of the voting people, of the voting delegates or whatever, we people of color. And I mean by that Hispanics, Blacks, Indians, Asians, people of color, or those whose primary language is not English. I'll just put the word language to remind you that it means those people whose primary language is not English. Now, there's another kind of a point four, which is just a minor point, but it's sort of important to me, and that is that the periodical, the new church publication of this church, will have a board running it of 10 people, and two of them must be people of color or people whose primary language is not English. So we'll have this kind of input into what we read. Now I'm just going to pause a little bit and see Do you know why that caused controversy? Do you know why that stirred things up? Did it stir you up? What do you think of that? Well, we've only got 0.6 right now. Remember I said that? We've only got 0.6. In the American literature, it's a little better in the LCA, but we got to go to 10% in 1988 in terms of the voting people. There will be some kind of a disproportionate number of voters in that group if you look at just sheer fairness.
We in the Northwest have had a very difficult time with that on the border regions at BLU. We have a black man who is also on the several national committees, who is also on other district committees, and we run him all over the church trying to fill a position that we have someone of color in that position. We simply do not have people, and I think one of the other things is that we put people into those positions who are not qualified by no fault of their own, but simply do not have the opportunity, and consequently they have no position of leadership, and they find themselves overwhelmed in that setting and often leave the church.
I know it's happened to me. I've seen it happen. Now, the experience has been a bit more positive in the committee that is constituted in the Lutheran Church. That has met these kind of guidelines, the committee that's actually formed this church. And those people in that committee have, to my knowledge, at least what I've heard, have really learned, not only learned a lot, but have really provided some excellent leadership. They are the cream of the crop, of course. Now, I want to remind you that it does say in the final wording, a minimum goal. It does not say that we can't vote on the first, we won't have a quorum or something, if we don't have that from the very first vote there. But what, despite the fact that you may disagree with the goal, can you try to get into the goal enough to say, can you understand why people would want to make such a goal like that for a Lutheran church in America?
That's what I'd like to know.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to think about it. Why make that goal? Anybody? Can we think of any reason at all?
White.
Yes.
Not enough of the minorities.
All right. Of course, when you tend to have a large representative assembly, then that's predominantly white, and they are electing somebody to go on to some other level of the church, their likelihood of electing a single black delegate to that convention is quite small. They're more likely to not only elect a white person, but to elect a white person who's been in power for quite a while. He really knows the church well, knows the system. You know, it's been 25 years now about since I've been ordained. I'm a very likely candidate to be elected to things in the church. I'm white, I'm male, and I've been around enough that I should know something about how the church functions. Okay. So that's one reason. Give me some other reasons. Why would this New Lutheran Church want to do this?
Well, I was thinking it's a pretty big embarrassment to be a church preaching the gospel and, you know, all this stuff and incredibly racist, but what a public embarrassment. It's like having that embarrassment, it's almost easier to declare ourselves under judgment and put ourselves into that kind of a discipline than to let, you know, other folks do that for us.
Are you using the words embarrassment and a kind of self-judgment or a judgment that would be evident to the world? There's some of that in this. It's a sense of confession. We failed. Yeah.
The poor people are recruited for that. It makes it simply, what you were alluded to, it makes people much more attentive to and concerned about getting people represented as people of color. But maybe, perhaps even the most important thing is that having 10% in a national convention of people of color is going to add an incredible new dimension to any decisions and perspectives that are brought, and that it's a matter of bringing a perspective and a worldview that has probably never been there. If you only have 1% of the body being that, it's going to be lost. If you have 10%, it's visible, and it's going to be much more of a contribution to what the church does and sees itself doing.
They are already planning, as part of the constituting convention, the Sarkisian Church, a huge multicultural celebration, which will celebrate the rich diversity that we finally have in this Lutheran church all over America. Now, I know a little bit about the Pacific Northwest situation, and I know a little bit about Minnesota, where, believe me, we have a very small minority population. But remember, I said I came from California, and I spent some time in Texas and Arizona. I still have a feel that our call as a church is not just to our membership, just like in my local congregation. That's not my call as a pastor just to minister to the members, but I'm called to the parish, to the neighborhood. So it is the church's call to society. A society that is very pluralistic, very multicultural. So you've given me some good reasons. I'd like to add one more, and that is I think that we have to share power. And the way you share power is you give people access to the place where decisions are made, to where the money is spent, and if they are not equipped yet to handle that power, which many of them are not, we have to figure out how they will be equipped. That may mean that if they really see that there's that chance for them to be elected to that position, that they will take seriously the local pastor who says, I want to spend some time talking about Lutheran history. And let's take some time talking about how decisions are made. And we would like you to serve your time on church council here before you go to another position. Sometimes we have very sadly, and I identify with what you're saying, we've very sadly taken a new Lutheran who never even was on the local church council, who's hardly even been in worship on Sunday morning, and pretty soon we put him on some national board. That's craziness. You know, I mean, I don't support that at all. But now we're by the very statement of the goal, beginning to open up a new future of power sharing and equality within the church. So, there may be a new day.
I think we have to lay a little bit on the laity at this point. In my ministry through the years, was served a congregation in downtown Saginaw, Michigan, 50% black. And I could not bring our people, our Sunday school teachers ready, could not bring our people to receive a black person. All the Lutheran pastors in Saginaw banded together that we would not receive one black into our congregation, lest people would move from that parish into the other parishes. We could not move that. And I don't think it's happened to this day. In my parish and in our son's parish, the one thing that I have run into from time to time is, Pastor, you're spending too much time with other people. You're our pastor. And I think, as you said, we are pastors to the community, not to the congregation. And I find the congregation wanting to limit the pastor's ministry to their needs and their congregation.
I told the story the other day, but some of you weren't here, so I can tell again, is when racial integration first happened in the congregation I served, a pastor named Alf Krabbel was the pastor at that time, and couple of lay people went out knocking on doors, and they met this young couple that were very interested in the church. The man was black, the woman was white. They came over to meet Pastor Krabbel, and he welcomed them and talked to them a while. Before long, they actually said they might be willing to try being a member of the congregation. So in his usual practice, he brought their names before the church council. The church council said, we're not ready for that yet. We don't want to do that yet. Maybe a little bit later, we got to get ready, you know. And so he said, well, after a lot of soul searching, he says, well, you church council, I why don't you go over and tell this family why they can't join our church? Well, they joined, and that black man eventually became the president of our congregation. Yes, we do face some difficult problems, which I'm not afraid to label racism. I think that we still have racism very much alive. The goal will push us along. There's another goal that I didn't put on the board, but it's going to be in the Constitution document. That document is within 10 years of the new life of this Lutheran church, our goal will have 10% of our membership of the whole church being people of color and whose primary language is not English. Within 10 years, that's the goal. Now, the LCA has done stuff like that for quite a while, those kind of very specific goals, and their minority leadership program and recruiting people, and it's paid off. They have now added large numbers of people of color in the Chicago Seminary, in Mount Airy, in Gettysburg, and we know that they have done some work for quite a few years in the Caribbean Synod down south. The American Lutheran Church that I'm a part of has been slower to ever list those kind of racial goals. We've been so heavily upper Midwest and Northwest dominated. But this will bring us into a real thing to chew on. 10% within 10 years. We will have to be missionary by that. We cannot wait anymore for the immigration boats to come from Scandinavia or Germany. We cannot even expect that our people will have enough babies that will kind of keeping the church growing. As a matter of fact, the birth rate among Lutherans is about a zero population growth. So we're going to have to be evangelistic. We're going to have to work in new ways. Please see how much time we got.
Bishop Trout of the California is an outstanding.
He certainly is.
First, yes.
He is going to be here next summer.
Is he?
Oh.
Good. And Bishop Trout is one example of the importance of having people in power and leadership and the tremendous influence that that can have. Will Hertzfeldt in the AELC is another example of a black bishop. And although we celebrate these two black bishops, we need to remember that the Episcopal Church had black bishops in the early 1900s. I mean, we are really slow to come to this, you know, and those men are getting older. We need to be, as Will Hertzfeldt says, we need to be homegrowing our own black leadership from our congregation through baptism and confirmation and through our colleges and seminaries. We can't just reach out to a Baptist and sort of grab them and say, come and be a Lutheran minister. It doesn't work that way. We've got lots of hard work to do, but I'm excited about what this new Lutheran church might give us an opportunity to do. Let me see if I've included what I wanted to say, because I'll feel bad. Oh, yes. There's another thing we're going to do in this new Lutheran church, which I'm very supportive of, and that is we are creating some vehicles in the structure to affirm the role of lay people, the role of women, and the role of minorities. The lay people will be affirmed in a way as never before in the Department of Ministry in the new church. Maybe some of you know the work of Bill Beal and Laos and ministry out of Pennsylvania. That kind of effort of affirming that we are all in the ministry and that lay people's ministry is just as valid as the ordained. You'll hear a lot more about it in the Lutheran church. That goal of 60% will be that there will be articulate lay people more and more prepared to take that leadership. The role of women will be affirmed by more than just a women's organization or an LCW. But there will be a whole department in the church that has to do with the question of the contribution of women in the leadership of the church that will be closely affirming women theologians, will be advocating for women moving into new positions of leadership and teaching in our seminaries. And we will have women bishops in the new Lutheran church. And then that third area, the Department of Intercultural Ministry, we'll have, among other things, 9 executives working for the new church. 4 of them, well, it may be even more than 9. Counting support staff, I don't know what it will be. But there will be a department of Asian, Black, Native American, Hispanic. Each of those major groupings will have staff working in the national level towards this goal of intercultural ministry and this goal of 10% of people of color. That kind of staffing is a very intentional way when we move towards it. Theological education will have to be changed in the time to come. In 1986, only 4% of all of the students in our Lutheran seminaries were people of color. 4% in 1986, this year. If we're going to reach that goal of 10%, we have to not only get to 10%, but we have to go even, I think, beyond that, because it's a lot of hard work. I can tell you stories about parts of this country in Texas or among Chinese or Japanese people where the church in this country has worked for years with very little results, with very few converts, with very few people really believing that the Lutheran Church wants them to be part of us. So we're going to have to work hard at that. So our theological education is going to have to work. But that sort of brings me to the final part of what I wanted to say, and that's beyond quotas, even if we don't fully like the quota idea, even if we wish we didn't have to fool with it. I don't want to argue quotas anymore. I think it's already been determined. It's in the documents. Now I want to work hard in the years that are left for me, and I hope you'll work in some way in your own way, to deal with the racism of the church, to deal with its exclusiveness, to affirm different cultures of people, to find ways that we might really be pluralistic. You know the word? Pluralistic, meaning that we would allow people to be themselves and to affirm who they are and express in pride their own culture alongside of not giving up our own sense of tradition and where we have come from. I mean, I want to go to suppers in the New Lutheran Church where we have lutefisk, but I also want to go and have egg rolls and to eat the food of a Southeast Asian refugee. I want to be able to eat tacos in the New Lutheran Church and celebrate with the rich diversity of their culture and music. I want to hear black preaching, for some of the best preaching in America is the black preacher, and a great kind of gift of freedom and understanding of the scriptural story and the biblical understanding. I want from a Native American something I get at Holden, and that's a rich understanding of nature and the world, all interrelated with human beings. And I want
spirituality that I find in some of my Indian neighbors, very religious people in my community. And they know about Jesus. I'm not the one that comes to tell them about Jesus. In fact, I think we're learning that more and more. We don't bring the gospel to these other cultures, but we are brought by the gospel itself to be with these other cultures. And we understand that the gospel is already there amidst all peoples, and we must lift it up and affirm it when we see the message of God's love there found in all kinds of people. So, pluralism. In the last session on Saturday, if you're still around, I'm going to try to help us think about jumping out of the melting pot into pluralism. How we will be able to be a church that just doesn't ask everybody to lose their identity and kind of be like us, and how we really celebrate. And I think more and more American people want to celebrate the fact that we are very different people and can be as Christians. Now there's a couple minutes left, I think, or maybe 1 minute left. You got anything you want to add or detract? If I disturbed you a bit, I wanted to. I'm disturbed about this stuff. Yeah.
This comment's too hard here. But I spent some time with Alaska in the Eskimo villages, mm-hmm. and in the past few years, and I've been a deep minority in that area. Yeah. When I come down here, and I came to different churches, Lutherans, Catholics, Baptists, Protestants, but I hear about the races, and people say, well, we want 10%, or we want this percent in here. And I kind of wonder, and I see it, are we, and I'm not talking about we here, but I'm talking about we, as a generally speaking, in the United States. Do we really, as Christians, do we really want this percentage, or are we just going through the motions to do it? And if so, instead of 10%, say that we were all members of Christians in one particular church, say that we got, it was turned around, instead we got 10%, we got 90%. Would we stay within that church, or would we go where the majority is?
The history of church development in America says that clearly we would leave and go somewhere else. In fact, every church is in some kind of a transition. It's going, if it's in a racially changing neighborhood, it's either going all one race or the other. And we've tended in our history to move out, to go to the suburbs, to join another church. That's what we've done in the past. Will it be that way in the future?
Was that just showing how much of a racist we really are?
Well, if you're using the strong word, the people down at Pasadena say it's a homogeneous principle that the faith grows best and flourishes in our heart most when we can sing the hymns we love with people like we do it with and talk about it in the way we've always talked about it. I mean, they would understand that that's not a bad thing to be a homogeneous group. It can be a good thing. I think it can be an evil thing is if it loses the sense of the body of Christ, the oneness that we are part of, and if it really ghettoizes us, you know, if it really impoverishes us by pulling us into our own little like-minded group of people.
Yeah.
Yeah, and see, that doesn't just happen with white people. I think that can happen with black people, too, or Indian people. I mean, any group of people can get to that point where they become so exclusive and think that they want to be separate and not allow the contribution of somebody else. I don't want it that way.
Well, see, I've kind of been in that situation.
Yeah.
Being a minority.
Yeah.
And all my life, you know, I've been a majority. Mm-hmm. And then when you become a minority, you kind of see the other side of things.
I'd be interested to know, did you go into any Indian, Eskimo Christian gatherings while you were there?
Oh, yeah.
How were you welcomed? How did they accept you?
Okay, first of all, I was in a situation that these two Eskimo kids had come up and they fell through the ice.
Okay.
Supposedly they thought, you know, they felt that I saved their life because I took them out. Yeah. The next summer, I came to the village and they recognized me. Of course, they brought me in. They introduced me to friends and relatives and cousins. Which just about 90% of everybody in the village are related one way or the other.
Yeah.
So they accepted me real well. Not necessarily as Christian or
yeah.
with faith or religion, but to the fact of, you know, how I helped them, their son or their cousin, whatever. So I can't really say how they accepted me religiously.
Well, maybe that is a religious acceptance. I've found that the way we're working in inner cities with any kind of a success at all with people that aren't quite the same cultural background is by us being relevant to their real needs, what they ask us for. They're asking us for help with housing. If they want to deal with the question of the justice of the city government, we get involved in community organizations. We get involved in housing and food distribution. We become their friends before we talk about church. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I found this homogeneity factor very evident in the Eskimo community. I worked with five of them in the out of Nome, Shishinrak, Wales, and those. And we've done a pretty good job of teaching them to be Lutheran, because when we had an Eskimo conference that brings together Christian Eskimos from all over the peninsula, many of our Lutheran Eskimos had a real difficult time with some of those out of the evangelical churches or fundamentalist churches, particularly in the charismatic relationship. Yeah. And I'm not sure whether it came from them or our white pastors in that setting, again, but there the homogeneity was not only Eskimo, but it was Lutheran.
Yeah.
And they had difficulty relating to non-Lutheran Christian bodies to the place where they didn't invite some of them the next year.
Yeah. There's a couple things I'd like to respond to that. One is sort of an exciting development maybe you're aware of. Within the last couple of years, there have been consultations in Alaska about the developing of a theological training institute or theology by extension to train Eskimo leaders to take over those churches. And Luther Seminary in St. Paul has been involved in that consultation, and it'll be ecumenical, it'll be with other denominations.
They got to do better than Artos.
Yes,
got to be better than that.
And I am familiar with that, and I've been real pessimistic about Artos. I got a letter yesterday from the director of Artos down in Austin, Texas, and I'm pleased to know that they have just now graduated six from Artos that are Hispanic, that are beginning their ministries now this year. So that's some growth in the Artos program. But another story that matches what you said is I have a good friend who has been pastoring an all-black congregation in Detroit. And he did a good job. I mean, he was a faithful pastor, and he stuck there. A lot of the white members left while he was there, and he ended up with a small group of black people, but he did a good job. But when he left, he did a very wise thing, I thought, and that is he had prepared them for the fact that there should be a black leader, and there could be a black leader in that congregation. So they got a black leader. But the black leader was one of these guys who had been another denomination and sort of taken the college way or the exam to become a Lutheran pastor. And he was there only a year, and they kind of wanted him out. And the reason they wanted him out, he wasn't Lutheran anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, they were so convinced, they learned this Lutheranism so much that that became the big thing. And what they also needed, which is what I believe the Alaskans need, is they needed a sense of their own culture and a pride in their own story. And they needed to be able to affirm their own ways of doing things. And so that's the dilemma. I'm in an intercultural ministry, and believe me, in my church, I wrestle with, should we bring the sage into the worship service sometimes? Should we use the Indian drum? And we decided to do it. You know, we bring the drum right into the congregation sometimes, and we listen to it, and we have people sing in the Ojibwe language, which is not the language of most of our Scandinavians, but we are just living in that kind of a community, in that kind of a world, and we can be Christians together, even though we don't do everything just the same way. Well, any one last comment from any of you? I don't want to say it all today, or I won't have anything to say at the end of time, but I'll tell you where we're going to go. Tomorrow, and I'll give you the actual time, I guess, so that I got this. If we don't have a fire or a drill, tomorrow at the same time, we'll try to deal more with the question, can the Lutheran ministry get out of whiteface? What do we do about that fact with about 99% of all of our clergy being white? With 99% being white, what can we do about that? And then on Friday at 10:45, Barbara Rossing will join me, and Barbara and I will talk specifically about the inclusive question as it relates to women in ministry. I've had the privilege of working on two staffs with a woman pastor, and I've learned some of the great joys of that and some of the difficulties of that. I'll never forget when the woman pastor who I worked with and I sat in the church council meeting, and the head of our ushers raised his hand and looked to me and said, "Pastor, what do you think?" And I sat next to my co-pastor, and I knew what she thought. So we will talk a little bit about women and men in partnership, and then the final day out of Melting Pot into pluralism. I'd like to quote at the end a quote from a little reading by John Taylor called The Primal Vision. Our first task in approaching another people, another culture, another religion, is to take off our shoes, for the place we are approaching is holy.
Else we may find ourselves treading on people's dreams. More serious still, we may forget that God was there before.